This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the most powerful tools biologists use today is not some new DNA sequencer. It's not a gene printer either. In fact, it's not something we humans invented at all. It's something we borrowed from bacteria, a sophisticated self-defense they have, a molecular machine that chops up invading viruses to stop an infection. The tool is called CRISPR-Cas9, and it allows scientists to edit DNA, to modify or delete genes, and add new ones, too. It's already being used to develop new drugs, and its versatility is not without controversy. Like, should you use CRISPR to edit the genes in a human embryo? Should you use it to modify mosquitoes so they can't transmit malaria? Lots of big questions. But before we get ahead of ourselves, my next guest says this gene editing technology, well, it's not as easy to use or as much of a guaranteed home run as we have been led to believe. Carmela Haynes is an assistant professor in the School of Biology and Health Systems Engineering at Arizona State University in Tempe. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, we've been reading sort of a challenge about how easy CRISPR is to use. Rudolf Janisch of MIT said, quote, any idiot could do it. And that's been sort of put to the test and found out that any idiot could really not do it that easily.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So our lab spends a lot of time studying a system that is unique to any living thing that is basically made up of more than one cell. And so sort of the catch there is that any idiot could do it, assuming that there are no roadblocks or special things about how the DNA is coiled up inside of the cell that would prevent the CRISPR, I guess, sort of a scissors-like machinery to get in and actually access the target gene. Mm-hmm.
So for example, in human embryos, those cells are pretty well coiled up?
Indeed, yes. And so the thing about the CRISPR machinery is that, I mean, it is fantastic. It's very good at what it does. But over the millions of years that it's evolved, it's operated inside bacteria in a space where we don't see quite the same type of DNA coiling and packaging that we see in a cell like a cell in a human embryo. So the DNA in embryonic cells in particular has a lot of interactions deep inside the nucleus that sort of shield sort of package and separate certain genes away from the rest of the environment. So this actually poses a bit of a molecular challenge to the CRISPR machinery in terms of accessing the target that you're going after.
You know, whenever we talk about CRISPR a lot on the show because it is such a cutting-edge technology and one that is fraught with ethical decisions. And the more I talk to people around, they say, you know, it sounds pretty easy, but what you don't hear of are a lot of failed attempts at using it, a lot of trial and error and so on. Would you agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. So, you know, with when scientists publish what to get a higher priority are those success stories. So if you're, you know, there's a particular gene that has a lot of importance in medical research, there's a lot of work that's put into picking just the right spot on that gene that through trial and error, we find that CRISPR is very good at cutting. So what you'll see in a lot of the publications are examples of where it works. But, you know, due to the way that, you know, publications are structured and our general culture around reporting on successes and not so much failures, there's a lot of information out in the body of scientific knowledge that tells us that it doesn't always work quite as well as we expect it to.
Yeah. You know, it's CRISPR itself. The whole connection to bacteria is just, it's so fascinating, isn't it? That the bacteria have been fighting this fight with viruses. You know, every bacteria has a virus that wants to eat it, and has come up with this mechanism to stave it off, and then here we are sort of adopting it.
Oh, yes, definitely. That is a very, that's a fascinating aspect of the use of the system. I think that when scientists started figuring out how the system worked, they immediately started thinking about applications. There are things that are similar in the research community, like things called restriction enzymes that are also derived from bacteria that are very good at cutting up DNA. But I think that another, speaking of defense mechanisms, the cells of higher organisms, as it were, have a system that doesn't necessarily rely on cutting invading DNA. What cells like human cells like to do is sort of after the DNA finds its way into the nucleus, what has happened in a lot of cases, or at least we have a lot of evidence for this, is that special proteins that co-exist with the DNA inside of a cell nucleus will take the DNA and package and wrap it in a very tight structure so that those invading pieces of DNA can't replicate and excise themselves and move around and sort of mess up our genetic code. So human cells have their own defense mechanism that I think that, you know, in the early stages of developing CRISPR as a tool, we hadn't quite started to address that challenge just yet.
But you think it is an addressable challenge, something like that?
Oh, definitely. So a little over, well, just about 2 years ago, my grad student and I, so my fantastic grad student, Renee Dare, we'd worked with some other professors to start teaching a course on synthetic biology. So that's my field. We think of ways to put together, borrow bits and pieces from biology and make very useful tools. So we set out to develop a course at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and we decided to focus on teaching about CRISPR for aspiring synthetic biologists. So we sat down and thought about how to set up this lesson, and we wanted to make it very interesting. So we started looking into CRISPR, and we got very curious since our specialty is in DNA packaging and how to engineer that. We started asking ourselves, well, you know, since CRISPR, it comes from a bacterial system, it's evolved in an environment where it hasn't really been exposed to all of these complex packaging machineries. What if we actually challenged CRISPR with, you know, a packaged system? So we happen to have a very nice engineered human cultured cell line that we use in the lab to probe questions about engineering DNA packaging. And what we did was that we did a pretty simple experiment where we artificially packaged a target sequence inside the cells and then introduced CRISPR and measured how good it was at cutting. And we found that in some cases, you can completely eliminate or completely block CRISPR cutting altogether if that target gene is packaged. One of the neat things about our artificial system is that it is built around the same machinery that stem cells use to shut down activity of certain genes that are involved in converting the stem cell into a specialized cell, like a muscle cell or a nerve cell. Right. So our artificial system, although it is artificial, it overlaps, it uses a lot of the same protein bits and pieces that stem cells use to make their genes inaccessible.
Really interesting.
Yeah, we think that our finding, which we just published in ACS Synthetic Biology, is extremely relevant to sort of looking deeper, more deeply into the challenges facing practical use of CRISPR as a tool.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in before we have to go. Let's go to Panama City, Florida. Matthew, welcome to Science Friday.
Gosh, thank you. So how many idiots are using this in the world? To get my mind around it, like, are there hundreds of laboratories? Are there thousands of laboratories?
Yeah, thanks for the call. Is that a fair question to ask, Carmela?
Well, I think I think the right way to think about that is thinking about the steps involved in using CRISPR yourself. I do agree that the technology itself is very accessible. Like, you know, tomorrow, if I decided to change my lesson plan here at ASU, I could develop a tutorial that would allow students to look at a publicly available human DNA sequence online at a website like NCBI and look at a sequence, teach them a couple of basic rules about how to target CRISPR to a site, and give them instructions on how to design CRISPR. So this is a customizable system where you can change nucleotide sequences that are associated with the CRISPR machinery to match the target that you wanted to go after and edit. So I could certainly teach those students how it works on paper. We could even walk through, okay, well, how would you order the DNA from a DNA synthesis company to build your own CRISPR, your customized CRISPR tool. But then the huge barrier, so it all is very, you can map everything out on paper, you can run algorithms to look for just the right target, but then when it comes to actually taking cells or an organism and then expressing it and getting what you want, there are a lot of complicated steps involved. So while CRISPR may be accessible to everyone and it's easy to learn how to use it, actually implementing it is quite a challenge.
So we're not going to see a home CRISPR kit for your living room just quite yet, but you never know how soon. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Dr. Haynes, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Carmela Haynes is an assistant professor in the School of Biological and Health Systems Engineering at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been more than 50 years since the FDA approved the first birth control pill for women wanting to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And since then, options for women have proliferated. More kinds of pills, implants, shots, IUDs, and more. What about the guys? The only truly 100% reversible option for men right now is condoms, which have a 12% failure rate at typical use. But research published last week on an injection of testosterone and another hormone had very good results. It suppressed sperm production below fertile levels for nearly 96% of the men in the study. Unfortunately, the trial was halted early by an independent board because many of the men reported side effects like acne and mood swings and depression. We asked men on Twitter whether they'd take a hormonal shot, a pill, or other option. This is highly unscientific, but a bit more than half said yes, they would. Another 20% were unsure, and the rest said no. More scientific surveys have also found men wanting more reversible ways to reduce their fertility and help their partners avoid pregnancy. So what's taking so long? What are the promising projects? How soon could we have the pill for men? My next guest is Diana Blythe, an endocrinologist and program director of contraception development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the NIH. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. A study co-sponsored by the World Health Organization published its findings last week looking at a hormone shot that suppresses sperm production in men, and we're talking about that. 96% is pretty good, is it not?
It's excellent, and that's one of the high points of the study.
And so what's the compound? What did they put together? I said testosterone. What else was in there?
Well, it's actually a combination of two hormones, and I could take a moment to explain how that works a little bit. But the hormones include a progestin, and that was one injection, and a long-acting testosterone that's called testosterone undecanoate. That is also a second injection. So there were actually two hormones involved and two injections.
And now,
the two hormones involved is very similar to the female method.
So it's the same two hormones?
Well, it's similar. So if you in the female pill, you have a progestin and you have a synthetic estrogen. And we're building on the interplay of those hormones to design something that will work in men. In this case, the men had a progestin and a testosterone. So the way this works is that in the ovary and in the testis, there has to be a high concentration of one of those hormones, which would be testosterone or estrogen, in order to have the production of an egg or sperm. And the other hormone, progestin, shuts down the production of the first hormone, reducing the levels throughout the body so that you don't get the production of either the egg in the female method or the sperm in the male method. But by shutting down the production of those hormones to a very low level, that means that circulating hormones are also very low, and those hormones have other functions. So in the male, in particular, it helps with maintenance of muscle mass, the ability to have an ejaculation, libido, and some other side effects that you wouldn't want to have as a side effect of this method. So we have to replace the testosterone, and that's what the second hormone does. It replaces it to the normal level in the blood, but it doesn't reestablish a very high amount in the testis, so sperm production remains turned off. However, the challenge has been that we don't have a testosterone that is orally active. And so there isn't going to be a male pill until we can overcome that challenge, because we can give the progestin orally, but we can't give the testosterone orally. Mm-hmm. So in the US, you have transdermal methods where you give it through a gel, and that works very well. In Europe, they have this injection, which replaces it in the blood, and that works very well for them. But we don't have an oral form. That's been the challenge, and it remains a challenge even for men who have a condition known as low testosterone, where they need testosterone replacement. Again, we don't have an oral form that we know is going to not have any bad side effects for them.
Yeah. Is there any connection possibly between a long-term dosage, as if you're taking, if this pill does work out, or the injection site does work out, of testosterone, and possibly elevating the risk of prostate cancer?
Well, the reason we want to keep the testosterone levels in the normal range and not in an elevated range, there is another way of reducing that testicular testosterone through feedback, which is to give very high amounts of testosterone. And that study was done in a large number of men in China. And it was very effective, again, but it required large amounts of testosterone injections. So our goal is to try to avoid having the serum levels that would circulate to the prostate to be higher than the normal range. We don't want to have a situation that would cause something long term. But again, when you ask why has it taken so long, it's the challenge of trying to develop a drug for a healthy population that is going to be taking it for a very long period of time. And oftentimes, an untoward side effect doesn't show up until you have a very large population mm-hmm. who've taken something for a very long time.
In the study, I understand that the men, after this study was concluded, the men, many of them wanted to continue with it. They didn't mind the side effects.
So that was the other, I think, very positive thing that came out of the study, is they had a very high percentage of men who found the method to be acceptable. And remember, these were two fairly large volume injections every 2 months. So it's not as easy as taking a pill once a day. But they found it to be acceptable, and a very high percentage said they would use it if it was available, which is encouraging.
And so why would you not make it available? Why not continue testing it if there are a lot of men who would take it?
Well, in our program in the U.S., we are continuing a method. We're at a similar stage, maybe a bit behind this study, in that we are beginning an efficacy trial with, again, two hormones. One of them is a progestin. The other is testosterone, but they're delivered through a gel, through a transdermal method. And we've shown that in a six-month study, we can effectively suppress sperm production in the men who use it. And again, they find it to be an acceptable method. So our plan is to go out into a larger trial in which couples would use this as their primary method of birth control, the same way they did with the injection study. And we are very hopeful that we can overcome perhaps some of the effects that may have been caused by fluctuating hormone levels that one gets when one is taking an injection every 8 weeks, because initially you have a fairly high amount and then it trails mm-hmm. off until your next injection. And that may have been, it's not clear, but we speculate that that may have been one of the things that led to more mood issues or potentially greater side effects.
Our number 844-724-8255, lots of callers. Let's head out to Denver. And Jessica, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Hi. So I wanted to comment real quickly on the double standard between men and women and the side effects we experience. I've tried about 6 different birth controls. Depo Provera made me manic and suicidal, yet that is still on the market and considered acceptable for women to take. I had to go to the emergency room when I got my first IUD. I had false contractions. I was heavily medicated in order to stop internal bleeding, yet I'm on another IUD. It is still a great form of birth control, but still accepted. Again, we all know women talk about emotions and acne, but it wasn't the men that stopped the study, and I'm aware of that, but the committee that stopped it. And it's really upsetting to think like, oh, men can't be physically inconvenienced when it comes to birth control, but that's okay if women are. Mm. It's okay that I was suicidal and that form of birth control is still on the market. So I don't know. It's just kind of a comment about how upsetting that is to women in society that, you know, what happened with the men in the birth control. But then Viagra has way more side effects and way more serious side effects than the birth control had. Mm-hmm. But
I hear you. I hear you, Jessica. Let me get a good comment. Let me get a reaction. Thanks for calling. Dr. Blythe?
Well, I would say that we have a number of alternatives for women, and we don't want them to be taking a method that would potentially make them suicidal, and it doesn't work. It doesn't affect every woman that way in terms of an individual product. However, the first methods that did come along for women actually had a much lower safety profile than the ones that we have now, and we continue to work to make methods more safe with fewer side effects and more acceptable. So we're at a much earlier stage with men, and I don't think that the committee, there were 2 committees that reviewed the data. One of them said go forward, the other said stop. So they erred on the side of caution and they stopped. But I don't think it was the side effects of acne and mild mood swings that caused them to make that decision. I think they were concerned because there were 3 serious side effects, that one was a suicide and an attempted suicide. And that was felt to be a potential risk that they weren't sure was worth taking if they continued that study. However, as I said, there are other studies that are going forward that we hope would be safer and potentially not cause those side effects. The important thing here is to learn from what they found and to move forward with the knowledge and try to improve the products, improve the method, and come up with something that will not have an adverse effect that could be serious.
And
we're doing the same thing for female. I mean, I don't want to leave that aside. We're trying to replace some of the molecules in female methods to make it more safe for a greater population of women. But with mm-hmm. every method, the woman should certainly consult her physician. And if that method is causing side effects that she finds to be unacceptable, then she should definitely look at a different method, because not all methods affect all women the same way.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the new gel, that's what you're studying now. You think
yes.
that may have fewer side effects or less?
Well, so the gel is applied to the skin, and it forms a reservoir, if you will, in the skin. And so the release of the hormones is fairly constant. You're not getting fluctuations that are very high or very low, and the ratio of the hormones remains pretty constant. So mm-hmm. we're hoping, because we know that if you have an imbalance of hormones, that can cause a problem. So in a situation where you were injecting every 8 weeks and the hormones have a somewhat different disappearance rate, then it's a possibility for an irregular or a fluctuating hormone level that is not optimal. In this case, if you're applying the gel every day, then we expect the hormone amounts to be about the same and not have that fluctuation. Of course, it would be a user-controlled method, the first one since the condom, but that requires men to be willing to use it every day, to not forget to use it for more than a couple of days, because the potential for losing effectiveness, the same with methods that require a woman to take a pill every day, the failure rate is higher when it's not automatic, when it's not there all the time.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Diana Blythe of NIH on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Give you a chance to catch your breath and take a little sip of water. And this is still, how long we've been talking about, 50 years about contraception, is still very much a topic of discussion, male versus female. How much more difficult is it to develop a male hormonal contraception than female? What's going on in our bodies that make this so much more difficult?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think part of the problem is the challenge of getting the testosterone to be in a form that would be conducive to a daily method, such as a pill, which would make it easy to use. Injections are harder to regulate and have to be done by a service provider, whereas a pill you can do at home. So we're working very hard to try to find a method that will be convenient, that will produce the kinds of effects we expect. We know it can work, and we're really excited that it did work so well in the population that used it. So that's encouraging, and that the men liked it and didn't experience side effects that they felt would have caused them to want to continue. So I think it's the men, I don't want to be hard on the men, I don't think it was their choice that they couldn't continue with the method. So they were willing to tolerate whatever side effects they were experiencing.
You know, what I found interesting in the research on this is that the lead authors on last week's research said that there's no more funding at the World Health Organization for the male contraception. And industry is not interested in this. I find that really interesting. You know, you would think that this is something they could sell to everybody.
Well, that's a question that one needs to ask industry. They used to be more involved in trying to develop a method. There were two companies in Europe, one AG, Schering AG and Organon. Both of those companies have merged with another company, not the same company. And after the merger, in each case, a decision was made to shut down their male contraceptive development program. So, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But
are they just waiting?
Happens,
are they waiting for public money to do it, so then they come in and just then make the profits on making the product?
Well, I think there are a number of issues, and again, you'd have to ask them what their position is. But I think the challenge that everyone asks, when, especially when something comes out, is how long is it going to take to get a method? If you look at this particular method that they were working on in Europe, it was a 4-year study. And the study we're about to begin, which is a phase 2, is also designed to be a 4-year study. If we complete that and everything goes really well, then we have to go to the FDA and have permission to do what they right now would say are 2 phase 3 studies, which are large and long.
I would say
it's a lot of money and it's a long time, and it's a lot of men who have to be exposed to the product because they're healthy.
Yeah, and we don't know what the long-term effect of that's going to be yet. Diana Blythe, Contraception Program Director at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know that spinach you have sitting in your refrigerator at home, waiting to be turned into a tasty salad, a side dish, or getting ready to be recycled? You know what I mean? The compost heap. Well, it's actually good for more than just eating. My next guest gave this superfood superpowers, and that is the ability to detect buried explosives. Spinach that can detect buried explosives. And not only can it detect those bombs, it can send a signal to people about what it's found. It's a plant-to-human communication, the first of its kind. Joining me to discuss it is Michael Strano, professor of chemical engineering at MIT. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great. It's my pleasure to be here.
So what you've actually essentially created is a bomb-sniffing plant?
That's right. It's a plant that can detect explosive molecules in the groundwater or in the air and send that information to your phone.
So how does it do this? What did you do to the spinach?
Well, we used two types of very small particles. We call them nanoparticles. They're small enough to get into pores within the plant. So the plant leaf has pores called stomata, and the plant uses them to evaporate water from the leaf. But you can use those pores to get two types of nanoparticles in. These are single-walled carbon nanotubes, or rolled cylinders of graphene, and they emit light in the near infrared. This is light that's so red that your eye can't see it. Your television remote control uses this kind of light.
So the plant is shining in infrared.
Right. It fluoresces. So if you shine light on these particles, they'll send light back at you in this infrared region, so red that your eye can't wow. see it, like your television remote control.
So how long does it take for the plant to do this?
It takes about 10 minutes. It depends on the size of the plant, but also the evaporation rate. So how much sun is shining on the plant?
Hmm. And so what's the idea? How could you make practical use of this now?
So this this is part of an effort that we have at MIT to try to modify living plants to replace some of the devices that we make today and stamp out of plastic and circuit boards. So I call this area plant nanobionics. And the technology we developed could have applications to monitoring groundwater contamination around chemical plants, monitoring public spaces for terrorism. There may be defense applications, but we're also taking these same sensors and we're turning them inward, and we're connecting them to the plant to help us study and understand plants. Plants have an extensive chemical signaling inside. They know when they're under attack from pests. They know when there's a drought coming. So this information is useful to humans, and so we're also interested in getting this information out of the plant and to in a form that humans can use.
So if you can do this in spinach, I imagine you could do it in other kinds of plants too.
That's right. In the lab, we've used spinach, watercress, or arugula. We also use plants that are commonly used for plant research, like there's a plant called Eridopsis. But we made a point in our paper to show that we could use these techniques on any plant, any mature plant that you find in the environment or in a nursery. We call them wild-type plants. So you don't have to genetically engineer or use a very special kind of plant or plant species. So that was an important part of what we showed, that you could go up to any mature plant and modify it in this way.
And how hard is it to modify? Do you just sprinkle on the nanoparticles and it just goes right into those little holes in the leaf?
You essentially can just sprinkle on. We use a needleless syringe to apply a solution of the nanoparticles. We pressurize the solution on the surface of the leaf, and then this backfills spaces within the leaf where water is normally stored, waiting to be evaporated in the plant. So however, we're working on ways that you could treat the water so that it will just the nanoparticles will infuse into the plant without that pressure. So there, you could in fact just spray the leaves, and you would get and you would have the particles be incorporated.
Could you find plants that could detect, let's say, traces of explosives in the air, like sniff it out instead of taking it in through the roots?
So yes, we showed in our paper that if you apply the explosives on the leaf surface, actually the response is faster. So you can detect molecules both in from the air or the water, and the method isn't just useful for explosives. We showed that you could detect dopamine, and in fact, we're working on a wide variety of sensors that you could put into the plant, and also combining them together to get lots of information in one set of infrared signals that come from the plant.
Now, I'm going to parse this a little bit. You said dopamine, which to me is a neurotransmitter, which I move that to the next category of nerve gas.
That's right. So dopamine is interesting. It's present in plants, but also we were interested in showing that we could detect molecules that are foreign to the environment. So we chose explosives. They shouldn't be there in the groundwater or the air. But we're also interested in detecting biological molecules that you can detect that are part of the plant and part of the plant's signaling network. So really, we were showing examples. There's we can detect almost any molecule in this way. So we're trying to demonstrate that it's a very generic technology.
Wow, that certainly would be a cheap way to create a detector. You're just using any plant that you can incorporate.
So plants have some advantages for being used in this way, and I don't think engineers like myself have really seriously considered them as a platform. They provide their own power. They can move water from the ground to, in some cases, hundreds of feet in the air with no additional energy added. They use just water evaporation, and they self repair, and they're naturally adapted to the outdoor environment. If you think about what it takes to have your cell phone sit outside for year after year in extreme cold and right. and in the sun, it's an engineering challenge, but nature has essentially adapted to this task.
So if you wanted to create a protective perimeter around something, you can just grow a lot of rhododendrons or something,
existing plants and modify them and set up a sensor network. That's right.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that the Pentagon must be interested in your research.
Well, I don't know anything about that, but
you haven't got a call from DARPA yet.
We're certainly interested in problems. not yet, but we're interested in both. So plants are naturally adapted to detect things in their environment. They for as large and extensive as a tree is on the surface, its branches.
Yeah.
If you imagine it upside down, its root network is just as extensive. So plants and trees are really ideal for monitoring really large areas of groundwater.
How can you triangulate the plants to actually find it? Let's say there's a bomb in the soil, you know, you get two or three, three plants, and then can you actually find out the exact location?
Ira, you are brilliant. Yeah, no, this is actually...
Can you quote that again? I'm sorry.
No, this is actually, this is what your cell phone does. If you have three plants and a distance apart, right, you can actually pinpoint the location approximately by using the arrival time of the chemical signal to each of the plants.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go next with this? I'll give you my blank check question I give to a lot of scientists. If you could, you know, spend an infinite amount of money, what would you like to know next and to create next?
So the thing that we're really excited about now is actually turning the sensors inward towards the plant and being able to tap chemical signaling in the plant that can tell whether the plant is stressed. And this has many applications to understanding and improving agriculture, but also applications to what's called urban farming and improving our ability to cultivate plants. But plants are also used to produce specialty chemicals. And it turns out that in order to increase their production, plants are used for making anti-cancer drugs and for producing flavorants and so forth. If you want the plant to produce more of those molecules, you have to activate a pathway in the plant that turns on when the plant is under stress. So we're interested in tapping into the signaling within a plant and seeing what kinds of information that it gathers in the mm-hmm. environment and could be sent to a user.
Now, that's really brilliant. Heck with me. That's great, interesting stuff. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck to you, Dr. Strano.
Thanks a lot, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Michael Strano is professor of chemical engineering at MIT. If you're someone who needs a mobility device to get around, you know, like a wheelchair, and you're also a dancer, you might already have heard of the rolling dance chair. It's one of the first power chairs that is omnidirectional and smartphone guided. In other words, it goes sideways and forward and backwards and slantwise, all with just the lean of your body or the tilt of your smartphone. Julie Liebach, SciFry's online managing editor, wrote an article about the chair and how dancers are using it. Also, our SciArts video team ventured to the University of South Florida to meet the chair's creator. And you can see both on our website, sciencefriday.com/dancechair. Julie's here to tell the story and explain what makes this chair so exciting for folks in the arts and disability communities. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Ira.
So give us the truth. What's going on here? This is interesting. Why is this dancer, and why did she want to develop a new kind of chair?
Okay, so the inventor's name is Mary Lynn Morris, and she's actually a choreographer and the assistant director of the dance program at the University of South Florida. And as you would imagine, she's been dancing for as long as she can remember, so that was a bit of an influence. But she had a few formative experiences in her life that inspired her to start thinking about making a chair like this. So when she was 12, her dad got into a bad car accident, and it left him with brain damage and reliant on a wheelchair. And so observing her dad use his wheelchair, she realized that it wasn't exactly user-friendly. So a few years later, when she was working at USF, in 2001, she started collaborating with dancers with disabilities. And many of them, while they might not have had mobility in their lower body, they had some mobility in their upper body. And so at this point, Mary Lynn started thinking about mobility devices as interfaces between human beings. And so she really wanted to build a chair that could explore new types of movement. So for Mary Lynn, it's all about movement. Dance is movement.
Dancer, yeah.
So she applied for a grant, got it in 2006, and worked with the engineering department at USF on what she calls a rough draft concept of the chair. And then after that, she hired a professional team, a small team, a programmer and a designer and a fabricator. And they came out with this prototype, which is the one that you see in the article in the SciArts video that we did. And that came out in 2013.
And she, in that video, she shared some of the reasons why the chair excites her so much.
Freedom of expression, creating new movement possibilities. You know, that's what we're always sort of exploring in dance. There's a tendency with disability for folks to think of the tragedy or the challenge, and that's not where the emphasis should be. That to also recognize that there's a lot of innovative potential and there's a lot of opportunity.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato with Julie Liebach. So this dancer, Mary Lynn, she's super excited. I could watch the video. I mean, your experience writing the article?
Yeah, I think she was. She's been working on this for a while, you know, over 10 decades at least. Over 10 years at least. That would be a really yeah. long time. A lot of devotion there.
It feels like 10 decades.
It might sometimes.
But what I found from watching the video is how the chair can do everything. And she can, you move it like, you know, just by thinking about it almost. But
yeah. So here are some of the salient features of this chair. If you look at it, you'll notice it's a stylish power chair. You know, it looks kind of futuristic. It has this clear seat. This is all by design because remember, this thing is for dance. It's for performing, so it's got to look good, but it's also got to function. It's got to move in all sorts of directions like dancers do. So one of the interesting things about this chair is, as you mentioned in the intro, it's omnidirectional. So manual wheelchairs and most power chairs cannot move diagonally. This chair can move diagonally. It can move forwards, backwards, side to side. It can pirouette, as it were.
Right.
And it can also raise up vertically, and the chair can spin independently of the base. So already you see there's all these movement possibilities. But the interesting thing, I think, is the way that it's controlled. So the general public is probably familiar with the standard power chair that's operated by a joystick or maybe a straw like what Christopher Reeve used. Well, this chair is controlled wirelessly through a portable control, which happens to be a cell phone. So Mary Lynn's team tapped into the motion sensing technology that's in a phone. And so how does that work? Well, a person who's sitting in the chair might either hold the phone or they will strap it to a mobile part of their body. And when they lean subtly in a certain direction, the sensors in the phone will pick up on their positional data. It gets cleaned up in an algorithm and then relayed to the base of the chair where the brains are, and the chair follows suit. So basically, this, if you lean a little, the chair follows, and it all looks very seamless to a spectator.
And I imagine not only dancers, you know, there's a great future for dancers, but, you know, what about everybody else who needs a chair?
Right. So while Mary Lynn was thinking about using this chair for dance, she's also been thinking about how it could be used in everyday life. And I mentioned how it will move up and down. Well, you can move it up so that a person sitting in the chair is at eye level with someone who's standing, which is, you think about it, it's very important for social interactions.
And so we'll be watching the video. It's great. Thanks for a great
article,
Julie.
ScienceFriday.com/dancechair.
And there it is.
And you can read the article and watch the SciArts video.
Julie Leibach is Science Friday's online managing editor. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Ira.
Have a good weekend. That's about all the time we have for this week. We urge everybody to go out there and vote. Big vote coming up on Tuesday. And we'll be out there waiting for you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.